Hello, everyone. I'm Eric D'Souza, and you're listening to Crime Writers of Canada's podcast, where we discuss all things crime fiction with crime writing authors from coast to coast. Joining me today is Amy Techter. Hi, Amy. How are you today?
I'm great. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, let's start with a bio. You gave me a beautiful one, and I had to change it a little bit, so bear with me. Amy Techter has spent more than 20 years plumbing the secrets squirreled away in Canada's National Archives, Library, and Archives. Her debut novel, Honey Bee Emeralds, was a finalist for the Indie Book Award for Best First Novel. Her second, The Foulest Thing, was the first in a loose trilogy centered on murders and mayhem in the archives. It was a finalist for the Crime Writers of Canada's then-titled Unhanged Award, and later, in 2023, was shortlisted for the Howard Engel Best Novel Set in Canada. If you were listening attentively to what I just said, it would sound like she had written two debut novels, and there is an interesting story behind that, but Amy and I had chatted before about this, and I'll leave a link in our notes for you to hear our previous interview. Today, we're going to be talking about the third book in this series, Honor the Dead, which came out in April of 2024. This story takes place in the eastern townships of Quebec, and there's a line early on in the book where it says, Kate knew that things worked differently in the country. Amy, you and I are both from Quebec, and I often tell people that Quebec is sort of a different world than the rest of Canada. So let's start with setting. How do they do things differently in the eastern townships?
Well, I love this question, I'm just back from the Eastern Township, so my eyes and heart are still there. But I think the Eastern Townships is this really special part of the world. It's south of Montreal, right on the border with Vermont. And so, if people aren't familiar with kind of what that means, if they haven't read a Louise Penny book, it's really sort of, if you think of Vermont landscape, that's really what the townships is as well. So it's these rolling hills. It's very rural, beautiful mountains and trees and little villages, and which, you know, is wonderful. But there's lots of places in the world that are like that. I think what for me where the Eastern Townships is really special. Not only because I grew up there, but also because of that mixture of French and English and those two cultures as well that exist in the township. So, you know, it was originally settled by loyalists and late loyalists. So place names were English. It was it had a really strong English and Scottish, actually, settlement pattern. But then since then, of course, there has been more and more French influence. And so those two, there's sort of a historic English, but a more contemporary French influence. And so that is super interesting. So you get in fun place names that are a little anachronistic for in Quebec and, you know, but wonderful French cuisine, for instance. So it's a really cool combination that way. And then you have just all the sort of spiky challenges of living in Quebec that are challenges and also rewards, which is that you have to get along and people have to literally speak one another's languages in order to kind of communicate. And you have to be able to talk to your neighbor and you have to understand their point of view. And sometimes it's a different point of view or a different history or a different perspective from your own. And so I think that makes a really rich and interesting environment to live in and then to write about as well.
One thing that you have to approach, though, is language. So this is a predominantly French community, but you're writing an English story, and Kate's predominantly English, too. So she has to deal a little bit with how they look at outsiders. I don't think many people realize that they're actually very friendly people. Like, Quebecers, for the most part, are very friendly people. And they make it sound like English and French is this huge debate, but it's almost like this political thing. In actuality, being from Montreal myself, we switch between English and French just mid-sentence, twice in a sentence. And I see that in your book too. So how do you approach language?
Well, I am writing in English and I am conscious that French is a foreign language than to most of my readers. And so I don't want to alienate anybody by having too much French just in terms of being able to easily read it. So I've had drafts of previous books that, you know, were set in Paris and things. And my early readers were like, oh, I, you know, I was stumbling on all these French words and you need to tone that down. And I was like, oh, okay. So I try to bear that in mind in terms of accessibility for my English speaking readership. At the same time, exactly as you said, you have those interactions constantly, where you know you're speaking one language and you switch over halfway through. You don't even realize it. You can't think of the word in one language and then you say it in the other language, and back and forth and back and forth. And as you said, this is part of the charm and the joy of living there or visiting there. And so in the book, I really wanted to reflect, as you said, the Francophone character of the region. At the same time, I grew up as a second generation, I guess, Anglophone in Quebec, and so there is this weird, unique identity of this little English speaking pocket. And it's more so, Montreal is much more bilingual, but the townships there isn't a huge English speaking population there anymore, but there is, you know, there's school boards and there's churches and there's community. There is a vibrant English speaking community still there. There's newspapers, that sort of thing. And there's a lot of pride in that as well, because it's this funny little thing of being an English language minority in the Quebec language minority that is North America. So it's sort of hard to say, oh, we're a linguistic minority when your language is English, but at the same time, there are some real challenges to that. So I did also want to honor the existing and vibrant English speaking community and represent those people there. But what I tried to do is, I think all of my characters, I'd have to go back and double check, but I think all of my characters are fluently bilingual. And when I was growing up, that wasn't the case. You could still sort of have hung on to your English language and refused to speak French, but more and more there's an acknowledgement that there's a real value in learning that language. And so I might have my characters be Francophone, but they'll be speaking English for the sake of the book, as I said, for that accessibility for the English readership. But I'll try to throw in some words or some specific way that they phrase things to sort of capture that unique French cadence as well, which I so enjoy and admire. And it's so unique and makes the setting interesting and enriches the setting to have that other element to think about.
You mentioned Louise Penny, and many book lovers will know that Louise is also from the same region. Her fictional town of Three Pines is in the Eastern Townships, and she has still very strong roots there. I, of course, couldn't help but notice that Louise wrote a blurb for your book and said, and I quote, a literary joyride. I don't know. I can't imagine how that would make you feel from an icon like Louise Penny. So how did it make you feel, and even how did you get it?
Yeah. Very good questions. Yeah, I still, like when you said that, I started to smile. I think I need like a poster-sized version of that in my room when I'm feeling down. Yeah, so I was lucky enough for her to blurb my book, and I was really touched because, of course, she was writing long before I was published about the Eastern Townships. And in fact, I was living abroad for a few years with my husband, and her books started to sort of gain popularity. And so I was living in Belgium, and I actually was in the train station, and I was like, oh my God, this is a Louise Penny book. I've heard my like mother talk about this author lady near us. And so I bought it, and I was so homesick and sort of, you know, just sort of that kind of loose ends. And I was able to read this book. And of course, the mystery and the story was great, but I really latched on to the townships elements. Like she's always been a townships writer. So it was really special to get that blurb from her. I wrote her, we did, because we were both from the same area, we did have a few mutual people that we knew in common. So I was able to drop drop those names. And she's so lovely and gracious and wonderful and wrote back. And I gathered up my courage and said, would you blurb my book? And she said, yes. So that was how that I was lucky enough for that to happen. And I think I had a bit of an edge with my townships connection, which I worked.
I have to agree with you. You should probably make a poster. Yeah. Cover the book and the blurb, and you'll never feel down again.
Exactly.
When we talked earlier, about a year ago, in Speak for the Dead, you described Dr. Kate Spencer, your protagonist, as crusty, sarcastic, and prickly. I just started reading Honor of the Dead, so thank you for sending me an early copy. And I'm finding that Kate isn't so prickly anymore. I mean, a lot has happened to her, and in some ways she should still be prickly, but she's coming to terms with it, maybe? Or is she still prickly inside?
Well, I mean, this is like a growth, right? And the first book really catches her at a really low point in her life. And in sort of engaging with the mystery, it helps her start to deal with some of the issues that she's had. And so what I certainly want to show is her changing and growing and learning from the past and opening herself up. I think the fundamental thing about Kate is that she's profoundly and deeply lonely. And what I hoped by the end of the first book by the end of Speak for the Dead is that she had made a few connections, you know, tentative ones, not, you know, maybe not always the most healthy ones, but still she was opening herself up a little bit. And so I wanted to continue that. I don't want her to retreat back into that, to the degree of self-destruction she has. I'm glad you noticed that. And I'm not saying this is like some redemptive thing. And at the end she's, you know, Mother Teresa, but she's, we all are, I hope, trying to do a little better with every passing year. And so that's what I'm trying to reflect with Kate as well.
To those who don't know, Kate's a coroner, but she has ties with your job, Archives Canada. And when we spoke before, I told you, I used to work in information management for the Canadian government. So it becomes part of you, like that organization sort of skills. Is some of that piece of you, the archivist, again, written into this or weaved into this story?
Yeah, they're the Dominion Archives Mysteries is sort of my brand for this series. And so there's definitely moments where people have to go to the archives to help unpick the murder. Like I can't seem to write a story where someone at some point doesn't have to go look at microfilm. So there is archival research and history. History plays a part, definitely in the story, and Kate will be involved in that as well as some archivist friends. So
there are references to history, but I haven't researched it yet. The people you referenced within the gold, did you make that up?
No.
Or is that true piece of Canadian history?
It's a true piece of Canadian history that I'm really excited about, which is the Megantic Outlaw. So if anybody is from that sort of area of Quebec, they may have heard of the Megantic Outlaw. He is a real figure, like a, I'm blanking, but he's a, like a Billy the Kid. Like he's a Canadian folkloric figure who is based in reality. And he was a son of Scottish immigrants and lived in a Gaelic-speaking unilingual community in around Megantic, so a little further east than where I'm from, and got involved in a land dispute, went on the run from the authorities. The authorities, of course, were British English rather than Scottish, and so the Scottish community rallied around the outlaw and kept him hidden for months and months and months in what became, and it still is, the longest manhunt in Canadian history. So he was hiding out in the bush, and all sorts of stories of him, like, you know, daringly going, attending a ceilidh at a local place and the police running to catch him and him slipping out the back and the wily Scots keeping him hidden. So I grew up with that. My dad, you know, told me those stories, and there's a couple of books about him that we had in the house that we talked about. So I've always known about the Megantic Outlaw, and it was super fun and exciting to incorporate that into the story. There is, in my novel, there is an element of gold, possibly hidden gold or something, which I did invent, but the rest of the Megantic Outlaw is based in reality.
That's great. I always love it when we weave in some of our Canadian history into our books. It just makes it so much more interesting, at least for me. And I hope for other people too. Well, we'll leave it at that. By the time this podcast comes out, your book will be just launching. So best of luck to you. I also know you're a voracious writer. So are you already working on book 7?
I've got another book. I've moved away from mystery. I'm trying my hand at something else. So we'll see how that turns out. But I do want to return to the Dominion Archives mysteries and write at least one more in that series as well. So that's on my to-do list, but I haven't started it yet.
Excellent. It's great to hear. All right, Amy. As always, thanks for taking time to chat with us. It's always a pleasure.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.